Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Angeli. Well, we have the presidential campaign, all kinds of polls, you know. One poll has Senator John McCain leading Senator Barack Obama by 10% among likely voters. Others show them neck and neck, as you just heard Marilyn Smith say. There's a poll from Quinnipiac University in New York State that shows a 5 percentage point lead for Barack Obama in Ohio. That's poll taken after the convention bounce for Senator McCain and after he announced his selection of running mate Sarah Palin. So the polls are all over the place. That's a 5% lead, but, you know, the sampling error there of plus or minus 2.7 percentage points, so it could be much closer or much farther apart. I'm stalling a little bit here because Ron Elving is the senior Washington editor for National Public Radio. He is to be with us this hour, and we're not able to find him at his phones right now, so we're looking for Ron to provide us some guidance and some wisdom here. But in the meantime, we'll talk a little bit about the presidential campaign. Oh, by the way, we're at 614-292-8513 as we are attempting to get Ron Elving on the phone. And you can always email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Just a word about the emailing comments and questions. You'll stand a much greater chance of, being heard on the show and your question being asked or your comment being relayed to the audience if you keep them short. You know, a short paragraph is really good. If I look over at the monitor and there's 6 or 7 paragraphs, which sometimes happen, you know, it's just too much to read on the air. It takes too long. So if you keep your comments to openline@wosu.org short or your question really short, it's likely to be a little better, more likely to be heard on the air. Well, we're searching for Ron Elving. In the meantime, if you have a comment about the presidential campaign, 614-292-8513. We'll take your calls right now. And now, by the way, this whole uproar, and I just hesitate to devote any time to this at all, but it's a ludicrous uproar about Barack Obama's comment about lipstick on a pig. Let me tell you what Barack Obama said, and I'm quoting, I'm giving you the context here. I'm sure you've heard about all this. And Barack Obama said at a rally, he said, let's just list this for a second. John McCain says he's about change too. Except, and so I guess his whole angle is, watch out, George Bush, except for economic policy, healthcare policy, tax policy, education policy, foreign policy, and Karl Rove-style politics, we're really going to shake things up in Washington. That's not change. That's just calling the same thing something different. But you can put lipstick on a pig. It's still a pig. Well, that's the context of Barack Obama's statement. The John McCain campaign issued a statement suggesting, and more than suggesting, charging that Barack Obama had said something that meant to have a reference here to Sarah Palin. You know, you remember her remark in her address at the convention. You know, as a news person, you just have to say when something isn't true. That's simply not true. Senator Obama, when you look at the context, there's no reason to think that he wanted this applied to Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. When you look at the video, some members of the audience apparently thought he did mean that because you see them stand up and applaud. Now, that's not a standing applause line just to talk about economics and foreign policy and say, you know, it's essentially the same as Bush's. That's the charge from Senator Obama. But the fact is that it's really annoying to see so much time delivered to this, and which is essentially a non-issue. ABC News last night led their newscast with this story, and to their credit, they said, look, this is nothing about nothing. And they had a couple of clips of Senator McCain also saying, using the same phrase with regard to Hillary Clinton's health plan. He said it's a weird health plan. He said it's strange. And he said if you put lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig. So this is much ado about nothing. And I think a lot of it comes from cable news networks needing 24-hour coverage and needing something to sell their programming. But I think a legitimate news organization should not spend much time on this other than that simply, you know, you talk about it because people are talking about it. But I think that's pretty straightforward that we don't want to talk about it much because there's nothing to it. All right, 614-292-8513. Let's talk with you about the presidential campaign, and perhaps we'll get Ron Elving. We hope we track him down. Katie's on the line. Hello, Katie.
Hi. I'm calling because earlier in the broadcast, I heard the numbers for Ohio.
Yeah.
And my concern was basically, I went to Ohio State University. I'm 24 years old, and most of the people that I speak with that are my age are very energized for Obama. And I was wondering, when they do these polls, do they take into consideration that most people that I know that are my age group don't have landlines. They only have cell phones. And as far as I know, they are not published. And I wonder how much that could skew the poll results for Obama.
Yeah, it can skew the poll results one way or another. Yeah, people who have cell phones, my understanding is that people who have cell phones are not polled. So, you know, that is a bias in the polls, yeah.
Okay, because, I mean, I just feel like, you know, the youth is very, has a lot of energy with Obama. And I just wonder, you know, when I hear these polls, I feel like there's a big absence in that.
Yep. Well, Katie, remember, as Katie suddenly left us there, but remember, we are 2 months out, and the polls are going to vary this way and that. And, of course, as we mentioned, the latest Quinnipiac poll showing Barack Obama with a 5% lead over John McCain in Ohio. But that's just one poll. Joining us now, Ron Elving, NPR News senior Washington editor. Ron directs coverage of the Capitol and of national politics. You hear him regularly on NPR's Day Today and on Talk of the Nation. You can hear Ron and NPR political editor Ken Rudin on the weekly NPR podcast, It's All Politics, and you can read Ron's Watching Washington column at NPR.org. Welcome to Open Line, Ron Elving. Good to have you here.
Good to be with you.
And again, we're at 614-292-8513. Ron, I just finished talking with the listeners a little bit about this whole incident of Senator Obama's lipstick on a pig, still a pig, and I gave him the context of that statement and suggested that this is a non-issue and much ado about nothing. What do you think?
I do think it's a much ado about nothing in the sense that this is a phrase that people use quite often. The senator has used it himself on a number of occasions. John McCain used it back in November in reference to Hillary Clinton's health care plan, which she was talking about as a candidate for president back last fall. And Senator McCain at the time said that it was pretty much the same health care plan she had put forward in 1993 and 1994 as first lady, and it hadn't changed, and you could put lipstick on a pig, but it was still a pig. I don't recall anyone at the time suggesting seriously or in public that he meant that the pig in that case was Senator Clinton. I think it was clear he was talking about the health care plan. I think it was equally clear with respect to what was being said about John McCain's economic ideas earlier this week. Senator Obama was not even referring to Governor Palin at that point in his presentation or his remarks that day. So it is a stretch, to put it mildly, but it is more or less in keeping with the kind of aggressive ad-making and punch-taking that we've seen so far in this campaign, that somebody would jump on that and take it in that particular way. I don't think it's even taking it out of context. It's even beyond that. It's really a stretch and a reach.
Now, did you see the Washington Post article yesterday, as campaign heats up, untruths can become facts before they're undone? And they indicate a situation where both sides have exaggerated or distorted the remarks of their opponents.
Yes. Well, and I think that is to some degree something that happens as the campaign heats up. But I also think that there are norms and there are standards and there are precedents, and that over the decades, generations, that American political presidential politics have evolved, we have seen certain guidelines, if you will, norms by which the campaigns behave. And sometimes people go over these, and they, generally speaking, come back. What may be different now, we'll have to see how this thing shakes out, but what may be different now is that it seems that some of those rules are down and that the sense of sensitivity to what can be proven and what can be disproven on the part of the campaigns might be deteriorating, that they may just figure, well, look, we don't care whether it's right or not, and they're just going to put it out there. And I'm referring here in particular to Governor Palin's claims with respect to the Bridge to Nowhere, the project for $200-some million that Alaska wanted and that Congress, after some controversy, refused, and which Governor Palin is now taking credit for having said no thank you to Congress, which is not what happened.
Mm-hmm. Ron, in your Watching Washington column, in regard to Governor Palin, you wrote, surely there's not been another convention so dominated by a vice presidential candidate since the squabble over renominating Henry Wallace in 1944. And Gail Collins wrote in this morning's writing about this in this morning's New York Times, said, McCain, by the way, is the Republican nominee for president. You may remember him from the Sarah Palin convention in Minneapolis, where he gave a speech and was congratulated by Sarah Palin. So there's quite an uproar about this, huh?
You know, if you watched the last week, the two candidates have campaigned together nonstop. McCain and Palin. And the initial thought I think a lot of people had was that this was to, in a, some sense or another, keep her under wraps or keep her battened or keep her on script and keep her under the watchful eye of the McCain campaign. That may have been in somebody's mind at some point. But I think what's evolved is a campaign where the enthusiasm generated by Governor Palin, which has been enormous, which has really been unprecedented for a vice presidential choice, has really begun to pull the train for the McCain campaign. I mean, this is really what's driving the whole energy for the McCain-Palin ticket at this juncture. People are very interested in her, fascinated with her, positively and negatively, and it's turning out a lot of people on the positive side to attend their rallies. And people will say, you know, I wasn't very excited. I was planning to vote for John McCain, or I was undecided. But now that Sarah's on board, you know, now I'm really interested. Now I'm really excited. So it really has, to an unusual degree, become the McCain-Palin ticket as opposed to the McCain ticket.
Mm-hmm. You know, one poll said their results, white women shifted from an 8-point pre-convention edge, pre-Republican convention edge for Obama to a 12-point McCain advantage now. So that's quite a shift, and you could reasonably attribute that to, some of that at least to the selection of Sarah Palin.
Yes, it's hard to think of another thing that would be anywhere near that compelling, especially with respect to that specific demographic group. But at the same time, that ABC poll that came out earlier this week and has raised a lot of eyebrows has not been corroborated in other polls. Mm-hmm. A number of other polls that have been in the field at the same time, Wall Street Journal, NBC, the Scott Rasmussen tracking poll, the Gallup tracking poll, the Quinnipiac poll that you referred to a moment ago,
yes.
Those polls all show an effect, clearly an impact, for the Palin choice, but it is nowhere near as radical as the one that was in that ABC poll. Now, also, when you talk about a 20-point swing, actually, you just described it the way it should be described, that there was an increase for McCain and a decrease for Obama, mm-hmm. which combined totals 20 points.
Yeah.
And, of course, that sounds enormous, and it is enormous, and it is something that, as I said before, is eyebrow-raising. But all it takes to more or less reverse that is for one woman in 10 to change her mind back. If one woman in 10 goes in one direction, that takes 10 percentage points away from the candidate she was previously for and adds it on the other side. That's your 20-point swing. So it is possible for something like that to happen and be significant and within a matter of days disappear.
Mm-hmm. So what we're saying in terms of polls, that we may be, all of us in the media, we have to report them, but we should settle down a bit in terms of overinterpretation, that it's very fluid and can change very rapidly.
Yes, and that's not to say change rapidly in Barack Obama's direction. The thought that I've had in the last week as we have been in, you know, the ceremonial portion of this long, long campaign for the last 7-8 days is that we will not know for some while what her first or what her full eventual impact on the campaign will be. And while, you know, it's maybe a little bit intuitive to say that she's a skyrocket and skyrockets at some point, you know, reach an apogee and start to come back to Earth, and we can say it's never going to be any better than this, we don't know that. We don't know that. It's possible that her appeal will continue to mm-hmm. broaden.
That's
even
right.
As people learn more about her. And it could be that these initial polls showing the freshened interest of women in the McCain campaign will be succeeded by polls showing even greater interest on the part of women in her mm-hmm. campaign. That would not seem to be the immediate intuitive guess, but we don't know.
But we simply don't know. NPR News Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving with us. 614-292-8513. Chris is on the line. Chris, thanks for holding. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm enjoying listening to the commentary. I do have a challenge to the listeners, and perhaps your guests can comment on it. Listening to you yesterday, Fred, I think there was a comment made about people who vote on issues versus on personalities and the way people present themselves. And I would like to challenge some of those voters out there who, I think the comment was made that a lot of people are voting for someone who they can sit down and have a beer with, or their next door neighbor, or someone that they might meet in their church.
Mm, one of our guests made that comment.
Yes, know. Yes. And I guess my question to those kinds of voters are, do you want your neighbor or the person you sit down and have your beer with or the people sitting next to you at church, do you want them to be president of the United States? Do they really, do you guys really think that a lot of people understand what a president does?
Well, Ron Elving, let's talk a little bit about voter psychology. What motivates votes?
I do believe that many people do vote for someone that they like more than someone that they really imagine taking the helm of the nation or being the leader of the free world, to use a sobriquet that's been popular in the post-World War II era, thinking of the American president as, in some sense or another, the leader of all the world against the great communist bloc, or against, for that matter, terrorist states or what have you. Yes, in some sense or another, the American president has functioned that way, and I'm not sure that that's the case today or whether it will be in the future, but that's certainly the way we've all grown up thinking about the power of the American president. When you put that kind of awesome construction down on that person who is your neighbor or your friend having coffee with or having a beer with, yeah, that gets a little overpowering, and it becomes hard to imagine. But there is also, I think, in the American political psyche, desire to feel that if they had to, they could put their arm around or you know, shake hands with the president of the United States and not feel overawed, literally not feel overawed, feel that this was another person basically like themselves or like someone in their family or someone that they knew intimately. Whether that's realistic or not, and it certainly isn't shared by the people in other countries around the world by and large, it is a distinctly American kind of a notion, and we like it. And I think a lot of our pop art and a lot of our movies and so forth have really encouraged this idea of the president as just another guy or gal, if you will.
What do you think, Chris?
I think he's absolutely right. And I do see that in a lot of people that I talk to, that they, it is that I want to put my arm around, I want to feel a connection to that person. I guess as an educator and someone who hires people to step into a classroom, say, I want someone who's qualified and not just someone that is going to be likable. And I think there's a lot of knowledge and experience and a lot of really important qualities. How does someone make a decision that I'm afraid a lot of people are just looking at who can I put my arm around and be friends with, instead of what other qualities, what other education, what other knowledge base does someone have?
Yeah, Ron, I guess it's hard to know what the mix is in an individual voter or over a span of voters, isn't it?
This is one of the reasons why politics is an art and not a science. It's enormously difficult and imprecise to try to figure out what the deciding factors in the average voter's mind are going to be, particularly when we're still almost 8 weeks out. Things are going to happen over the next 7.5 weeks that are going to change a lot of people's minds. They're going to go back and forth. Some people have had their minds made up for years about this election, and other people will make up their minds when they go into the voting booth and not before. So it's very hard to know what exactly the mix is going to be. But I do think this likability factor is under some stress. And the reason I say that is because clearly in 2000, Al Gore, who actually did win the popular vote by 500,000 votes, was seen as somebody who was enormously well prepared, but not very likable by a lot of voters. This particularly came out in the debates. Al Gore was a little bit ahead in the race before the debates, a little bit behind after the debates, and I think it was partly the likability aspect of his performance in those debates that hurt him. Whereas George W. Bush was seen as quite likable, quite approachable, just another guy. That helped him in 2000. It may not be the judgment of the country 8 years later that George W. Bush was prepared enough to be president in 2000 and through these last 8 years, and that could have something to do with why his approval level has sunk to, well, to a low that is comparable to the lowest ever for a U.S. president.
Chris, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
With Ron Elving at 614-292-8513. Ron, Sarah Palin sits down for, I believe, her first post-convention interview today to record it with Charles Gibson of ABC News for playback on the news tonight and tomorrow night. If you were talking with Sarah Palin, what are some of the questions you'd like to ask her?
No, that's a great question. And I think every journalist in America would like to be Charlie Gibson today. It's a tremendous opportunity to begin to open a slightly different window on her mind. So I think that you'd have to ask a certain number of what I would call Barbara Walters questions. How did you feel when this prospect first emerged? When did it first occur to you that you might be the only woman on the short list, as she apparently was? When did it first occur to you to start having a kind of connection with John McCain and his campaign? What did you think when you actually got this phone call and your family and you were summoned to go down to Arizona and meet with a senator? Those kinds of emotional connection questions, because I think we're all curious about human feelings of that sort. I think then, of course, you'd have to move on to talking about her road to Damascus conversion in terms of her own political history in Alaska, where she started out being one kind of politician, very much within the Republican structure and establishment, and moving ahead, doing the will of the people who were running the show there, Senator Ted Stevens, Congressman Don Young, other people, Governor Frank Murkowski, the guys who had been in charge for a long time, and trying to get earmarks for the town where she was mayor for two terms, and really basically playing the insider game, and then leaving the mayorship after two terms under term limits, doing what the party wanted her to do, running for lieutenant governor in 2002, losing, and then turning around and saying, this is not working for me. And when the establishment gave her her reward job for running for lieutenant governor, which was to be the head of this watchdog commission over oil and gas, she at that point turned around. That's why I say road to Damascus conversion, really quite dramatic, and decided that she had seen enough of the way the good old boys club was running things in Alaska, and she was going to be a rebel. And at that point, she, among other things, quit her job on the commission. She filed ethics complaints against fellow Republicans. She eventually jumped into the fray to run in the primary against the Republican incumbent governor, Frank Murkowski, beat him, got elected governor herself, and after that has had a somewhat mixed record of being both a reformer on the one hand and continuing business as usual in some other respects. And that gets into more detail than we have time for right now. But I'd like to get a sense of why she turned around, why 2003 was this demarcation point. Everything before, everything after, quite different.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very good. Let us go. Time for one call here before we break with Ellen. Hello, Ellen.
Oh, hello. I have a quick question, and you may already have discussed this earlier before I turned on the radio, or it might not be appropriate. I'm not sure. But I was wondering why there hasn't been any discussion, or at least not much of a discussion yet, on Governor Palin's position on teaching creationism in the schools, because you hear, at least on NPR and other stations, but mainly on NPR, we're kind of the laughingstock of the world because there's so many places in this country that want to teach creationism. I'm just wondering why they haven't brought this up yet, at least on the Democratic side. And thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. Ron, I think that this has been noted by the news media, right, that Governor Palin wants teaching of creationism alongside teaching of evolution in the schools, that she favors that. Huh?
Yes. It has not been dwelt upon as yet. There are a number of other issues where her views are available. You surely can find them, and many websites, besides the very partisan ones or the very most aggressively attacking blogs and so on. A lot of more traditional, more conventional mainstream media are also detailing her many positions on many issues, some of which are going to strike people as very, very conservative, very, very traditional, and part of what would be considered the rise of the social conservative element within the Republican Party, which has been particularly strong in a lot of the north, of the western and northwestern states. I mean, the same community that's been very strong in, say, the state of Washington Party, the Oregon State Republican Party, in recent years, has been very strong in Alaska, and she represents that. And they are very much about returning to traditional values, having school and prayer, teaching creationism as a science, teaching it as something that is an adequate explanation alongside evolution for the origins of life on the planet, that sort of thing. Much closer relationship between religion and public life, bringing religion much more aggressively into public life, and that's been very much part of her political persona now for a number of years. So I think that's going to be brought out more. I think Charlie Gibson will get into some of that in the next couple of days. I hope he will. There are a number of aspects of her career, including this, that have not been the focus thus far, because obviously there's been a great deal of fascination just with the phenomenon. of her coming on the ticket.
Sure, and some people will appreciate her focus on creationism, and some people obviously will not. So will that
yes, and I think one reason the Democrats have not been terribly eager to jump on it right away is because they don't want to seem to be, in some sense or another, making this about religion. They don't want to seem bigoted against people of any particular religious attitude. And, of course, there are a great number of people, not just in Alaska, but all over America, who have very strong views in concert with hers.
Mm-hmm. NPR News Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving is joining us this hour to talk about the presidential campaign. We'll be right back with my guest and you callers after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Andrew Bacevich, a retired colonel who lost a son in Iraq. In his new book, The Limits of Power, Bacevich writes about the limits of military power in combating terrorism. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air will be here later this afternoon. It begins at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. You can listen to Open Line online at WOSU.org. We offer an archive of programs for streaming. You can also check out the schedule of upcoming guests and topics. Just go to our website, WOSU.org/openline. And you can hear today's big stories put in perspective on All Things Considered. Hosts Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, Melissa Block, and WOSU's Christina Morgan present a mix of news, interviews, commentaries, reviews, and offbeat features. Listen to All Things Considered weekdays at 4, now on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News and Classical Music. Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, sunny skies and a nice day in central Ohio, a high around 84. For tonight, partly cloudy, a chance of rain, maybe even a thunderstorm, and then a mostly cloudy night tonight with a low of 65. For Friday, more rain and a high of 75. And now, back to Open Line.
And welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. We're talking about the presidential campaign with NPR News Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. As a senior editor, Ron directs coverage of the Capitol and of national politics. And you hear him regularly on NPR's Day Today on Talk of the Nation. You can hear Ron Elving and NPR political editor Ken Rudin on the weekly NPR podcast, It's All Politics. And you can read Ron's Washington column at npr.org. If you'd like to talk with us now, 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Ron, we've got an email from a listener. This comment: the Republican lipstick response is a cynical election ploy. This is an example of the Republican half-truths and complete lies that are not being addressed. Enough lies and phony outrage and swift boat politics. Of course, our emailer suggests that whatever falsehoods may be being told, and that's, of course, a judgment call by the Republican campaign, that somehow the news media are not addressing them. What do you think?
You know, it's a common complaint that that the news media do not act very effectively as referees in a fight like this. I do believe that's correct. I don't think that we are very effective as referees. I don't think we're entirely comfortable with the role of being asked to call fouls or to award, you know, penalty kicks or to award free throws to one side or the other. What we are most comfortable with doing, and I think this is our most proper role in the way the country has worked over the last couple hundred years, is to convey information as neutrally as possible from all sides and try to get all sides and bring as much of that to the listener or the reader or the viewer as we possibly can and let the listener and the viewer and the reader sort it out. At the same time that I say that, and I believe that is our ideal function, I also recognize that human beings being as we are, it is difficult to sort all that out entirely, even handedly. People do want the media to weigh in and say, well, you know, this guy said this and this guy said that. The one guy seems to be correct in that it does add up that way using arithmetic, and the other guy seems to be wrong because 2 plus 2 is 4 and not 5. there are rare occasions when we can do that, but most of politics is not arithmetic. Most of politics is not a simple matter of just saying, well, this guy says this and that guy says that, and guy number two is correct. There is just too much value judgment. There's too much that falls into the area of speaking to a particular philosophy or another. And so you can have a debate in which everyone says things that are more or less true, with maybe being skirting the edge of untruth here and there, entirely making stuff up, and the other person is not entirely on the side of truth.
Mm-hmm. There are some newspapers, including our local Columbus Dispatch here, who do a campaign watch in terms of the 30-second television spots, mm-hmm. and do make judgments about whether they are accurate mm-hmm. or inaccurate. Mm-hmm. And, Ron, I'm sure you know factcheck.org from University of Pennsylvania, and they've taken a look at Obama spots and McCain spots and pointed to distortions on both sides, and you can go and see them at the website.
Yes, that's right. And there's also something called politifact.com, or excuse me, .org, I mm-hmm. believe. Now, let's see. Is it .com or .org? I'll check. But PolitiFact is a product of the St. Petersburg Times and the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is a very even-handed outfit. They've got a number of journalists with many years of experience and excellent reputations, squeaky clean reputations, I should say. And they do the same thing. And they try very hard to balance the degree to which they blow the whistle on the various candidates so that it doesn't appear that they are in anyone's camp. And I think that that's quite useful that they perform that function. So as I mentioned earlier, it's unusual for something such as the Bridge to Nowhere situation to emerge, where all of these websites and various watchdog types and taxpayer groups all agree that there are certain facts that are being misrepresented.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go back to our callers here with Ron Elving, and Cindy's on the line. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I have a question and a comment. First of all, Obama is a very interesting candidate and very extremely well-spoken and obviously highly intelligent. But when he was running on a campaign of change you can believe in and then selects Joe Biden, who's been in the Senate, you know, practically 50 years, I thought to myself, what kind of change is that? I mean, that's more of the Washington insider. I knew with McCain it was going to be a governor. He didn't have any senators on his short list or anything. And now he's picked someone who is inexperienced, but not much more inexperienced than Obama. Do you think that there's a great deal of interest in Palin because she is not an Washington insider? I mean, the people I know are just fed up with Congress, the president, and everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, Ron, that has to be one of the motivations for Senator McCain picking Governor Palin, huh?
Absolutely. I think he was tremendously interested in getting outside of Washington. There were a couple of people he was terribly interested in, very interested in, who were more insidery. Joe Lieberman, a Democratic senator from Connecticut, who is now an independent, having lost his primary in the Democratic Party in 2006 and then gotten reelected as an independent, he wanted to give it to Joe Lieberman in the worst way, or so we hear, but was persuaded that he needed to stay within the party and get outside of Washington, as your caller says, and to find somebody who would shake things up. And I think we've seen Sarah Palin has the power to shake things up. She did it in Alaska. She's doing it in this race. She is an electric personality, and she really knows the nerve that John McCain clearly has had trouble finding in the body politic before, which is, you know, that emotional issues that people really care about nerve that hasn't really been, you know, his stock and trade in politics. But she gets it, and clearly she does, and that's what's driving a lot of these terribly enthusiastic crowds. I do think the caller also has an interesting point about how both tickets in their choice of running mate got something that they needed but also sacrificed something that had seemed to be terribly important. In the case of Barack Obama, change, outsiderism, not being part of the club was sacrificed in Joe Biden, as she said, in order to get a little bit more experience, particularly on the foreign policy front. And over on the McCain side, as they had been extolling the importance of experience right up until they decided that somebody who'd been a governor for 20 months was ready to talk to the Soviets, or excuse me, the Soviets. I'm betraying them.
Right.
Talk to maybe Vladimir Putin is reminding me a little too much lately of the Soviets, but I meant the Russians.
Right. Now, I want to ask you something specifically. You said, so we have heard. Who did you hear that from? Did you hear that from John McCain? I wanted Joe Lieberman, but I couldn't get her. Or did you hear it from other Washington insiders? Is that actually true when you say something like that? Is that what he wanted?
I must tell you, I have not had John McCain say to me face to face, I really wanted Joe Lieberman.
Mm-hmm.
Or for that matter, Tom Ridge, another person that we believe he had a great deal of interest in. But he did say it to other people who have said it to me. And
those would be
them.
People that you believe would have the truth of that matter.
That is right.
Okay.
That is correct. And, of course, you're absolutely entitled to question that. But that's basically what I have to offer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this whole thing, when I saw Sarah Palin, I thought it's Jacksonian democracy meets dog patch. I mean, it is such an interesting thing. It'll be very interesting to see how it plays out.
Cindy, thanks for your call.
I'm laughing because you don't hear very many people refer to Jacksonian democracy.
Ah, okay. Kathy's on the line. Hello, Kathy. Kathy, are you here?
Yes.
All right.
Yes, I'm here. I have a question that I would love that Charlie Gibson would ask Sarah Palin. It has to do with the health insurance issue, but it also has to do with something she's going to face in her family. She has a 17-year-old who is engaged and going to have a baby. When she has that baby, if she marries the father, who will insure the baby? Will they buy private health insurance for the baby? Will the baby go on Medicaid and, in a sense, that is government health insurance? Is there a need for health insurance? And what does this have to say about other 17-year-olds who may have a baby? Is her child different than? And where is, you know, what will she do about the need for health insurance of her first grandchild?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a personal way of asking the question, Ron. What are Sarah Palin's views on national health insurance, on privatized health insurance? Do they conform to what Senator McCain would like to suggest in his campaign?
Yes, if Charlie Gibson is going to go there and ask questions such as this, I think he'll need to, as the caller did, suggest that it's ultimately a question about policy views, she should not be seeking one kind of coverage for her own family members that would not be generally available to the average American, because the average American is having a great deal of difficulty getting decent health care coverage that can be afforded by the average American.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a huge part of what the country is dyspeptic about and unhappy about these days. And yet it has not been much talked about in this campaign. It is not an issue that John McCain is comfortable talking about. He doesn't like to talk about it. And it's not an issue that is easily talked about by either campaign. And so it's one of those things that just gets kind of left by the sideline when the campaign is largely about personalities or personal narratives or whatever you want to call it. When we get caught up in that sort of thing, and it's easy to have it happen because, well, however responsible you try to be as a journalist, if everybody's suddenly talking about the lipstick thing, are you suppressing it if you don't talk about it and explain it and put it in some sort of sensible context? I guess so. So we're all talking about whatever we're all talking about, and it's hard to break out of that. I do think that a question that asked her views on healthcare policy, and perhaps personalized it by saying, now here's a situation a lot of Americans can relate to. You've suddenly got a teenager who's in this situation, not a student, but she's still sort of in your care, but then on the other hand, she's going to be married and she's going to be in somebody else's household. Who's going to provide the healthcare? That is a personal question which they might push back on and say, we don't answer personal questions. But it's also a personal question I think most people can relate to and say, yeah, how are you going to do that given our current healthcare system?
Mm-hmm. Kathy, thanks so much for your call. We're talking about the presidential campaign, clearly, with NPR News senior Washington editor Ron Elving joining us from Washington. 614-292-8513. Emails to openline@wosu.org. David is next. Hello, David.
Yes, I just wanted to say it scares me, the thought that we might have a lady president who's a creationist, which would, you know, divide the intellectuals in America from the anti-intellectuals. and we would have a little friction, a little heat going on here. It just scares me, you know, that somebody who believes God went poof, and there is Adam and Eve, you know, who doesn't believe in evolution, is going to perhaps be a leader of our country. That's just my comment. I just want to see what your yes. Thanks.
Well, Ron, that's one point of view, I guess. There could be another, huh?
Yes, I think Barack Obama had hoped, as a person who thinks of himself and writes about himself as a man of faith, a person who has personal faith in a traditional mainstream religion sense, had hoped that this campaign would be conducted on other difference or other elements of the total personality of his own candidacy and his party, and had hoped that this would not have to be like we saw in 2004 and 2000, to some degree, a contest between people of faith and people of a somewhat different faith or a different definition of faith. In 2004, many people feel, and I think being there in Ohio, you'd understand this rather well, in 2004, there was a big bump up in the number of people saying the most important issue they voted on was a moral issue or a value issue or traditional values, things of that nature. That was more popular than any other answer, including terrorism or the economy in 2004. Probably won't be this year, but in 2004, that was the case. And in states such as Ohio, there was a gay marriage issue on the ballot, which was perceived as being highly effective in bringing out a certain percentage, a high percentage, of people who had strongly conservative social views. And that would include, I think, opposition to gay marriage, opposition to abortion, and support for teaching creationism in the schools. That was a strong turnout element in Ohio and other places, and the vote was relatively close in Ohio, and had it gone the other way, we'd have a different president today. I don't think that same dynamic was working this year in 2008. There was nothing that was galvanizing that particular vote. The people were not that excited about John McCain. They didn't see him as one of them. They did not see him as a person who understood their concerns and values. And so that's why you see them suddenly so much more enthusiastic about John McCain now, because he's chosen Sarah Palin, who fits them like a glove.
Mm-hmm. All right. Back to our callers here with John. Hello, John.
Oh, yeah. I want to make a comment before I make my other comment, and that is, from what I've seen of Sarah Palin, when she was governor, she has had complete separation of church and state in that none of her, I don't know what to say, radical or compared to the general population views of religion ever took place. She completely left the religious side to the other. But what I wanted to talk about was bias in the media. Now, this pig thing is absolutely, it's a gotcha. The same as the House thing was a gotcha a month ago. And the two campaigns, McCain went and handled it, I think, a little better than what the Obama guys did a month ago. Obama actually distorted McCain's comments. They actually lied, where McCain did not lie. But my own personal opinion is it's a gotcha. I think Obama just thought, hey, this is the hula hoop. Everybody's talking about pigs, so I'll talk about them. And it was just a faux pas. And I don't think he meant, in fact, I know he didn't mean anything.
Well, let's talk around about the gotcha moments and the media and the exploitation of these moments by the various campaigns.
Yes, I think this is what campaigns largely devolve to, not just at this stage, but throughout. I mean, there's a competitive thing going on, and it's easier to bring your opponent down a peg with something of the gotcha variety, as the caller says, than it is to press home the superior virtues of your plan for Iraq or your plan for improving our relations with South America or trade or something of that nature. It's going to grab people's attention. It's going to grab the media's attention. The media professionally and definitionally have adult deficit attention deficit syndrome. We might even want to argue with the adult part. We just have attention deficit syndrome. We're always addicted to the next new thing. And if somebody says something that's a faux pas, if you want to call it that, a flub, I think it's probably smart at this juncture when you're running against a woman on the other ticket to never make any reference to lipstick whatsoever. There's just nothing it's going to gain you.
Yeah.
But it is an expression that everybody uses and that John McCain has used and that Barack Obama has used many times. He also made reference to wrapping a fish in a new newspaper. It's still an old fish. You know, it was an opportunity for the McCain campaign to get in a quick jab. And, you know, in boxing, a quick jab has the function not of knocking out the other boxer, but of rocking him back on his heels a little bit and distracting him. I think it's pretty obvious that over the last week, the Obama-Biden campaign has been rocked back on its heels and distracted.
All right, John, thanks for your comments. And on to David. Hi, David.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just my first comment, I guess, is and it's kind of ironic that there are so many callers calling in questioning Sarah Palin's religious beliefs, and the one caller made a comment about being it scared him, a woman who thinks God said poof and there were people. Last time I checked, I believe that Obama is considering himself a Christian. Which Christians believe in Christ being the Son of God, and poof, there was man and woman. And I would, you know, interesting comment that the gentleman made. With that being aside, my question to your guest, or my first question is, do you think that there is, or do you see a difference here in the interest level as far as religion and Sarah Palin, as opposed to several months back when it was almost taboo to talk about Senator Obama being born into the Muslim faith, converting to Christianity, Reverend Wright, and the what I would consider hateful speech that was spewed in the church for 20 years. And it seemed like it was almost that no one should talk about that, or we don't want to bring that up. And then all of a sudden, now Sarah Palin, everyone wants to know what her Christian beliefs are.
I understand. Ron Elving, maybe a precedent was set in the coverage of Senator Obama's religion, huh?
Well, I think there's an arc in these stories. There was an arc in the Jeremiah Wright story where it was the only story on the map. When it burst forward, when the actually some of the remarks had been known for some while and been printed, but when it got out on videotape and was suddenly everywhere on YouTube, then it became the biggest story there was. And in the early weeks of March, that was a dominating story. People talked about it a great deal. Then, of course, Reverend Wright came back. He had a news conference or appearance here at the National Press Club. It wasn't actually a news conference, but sort of turned into one. And he said a lot of incendiary things that forced Barack Obama, or led him in any event, to separate himself more forcefully from Jeremiah Wright and to leave the church that he had been going to for a number of years because of the attitude that Jeremiah Wright was taking. That was quite a dominating event in the public eye and in the media, and we, you know, talked about it and went on about it for quite some while. Yes, there were people saying that we shouldn't, that was a distraction or talking about religion rather than the issues, but clearly it was what everybody was interested in, and it was a dominating personality story for some weeks. Then the arc of that kind of passed, and we moved on to other elements of the campaign and other questions. I suspect we will with respect to Sarah Palin, too. I mean, we only have 8 weeks until the election, 7.5, really. And in that period of time, I don't know how much further the arc can go down. I think the initial burst of interest in Sarah Palin right now is burning white hot, and it's going to be white hot for a while for the same reason she draws big crowds. There's a tremendous amount of interest, enthusiasm, fear, whatever you want to call it, about this new person. 2 weeks ago or 10 days ago, no one had heard of her, generally speaking, outside of Alaska. Very few people had heard of her. And now, of course, she stands two steps away from being president of the United States. There's a tremendous amount of interest.
David, you'd like a follow-up question here.
Well, I was just going to say, I believe that the only thing that I have heard as far as Sarah Palin and her beliefs in teaching this in the school is that she wants both sides of evolution and creatism to be discussed. And my follow-up question was that the scandal kind of rolled with the comment about being a community organizer. And I was just wondering if anyone or if you're aware of anywhere I could find information where they've actually interviewed people who were in these Chicago areas. Like, is there a website that you could go on and you could read about the stories of the people that he actually helped? Because out of 19 months, I have yet to see one interview with anyone from these communities that he was supposed to be organizing and helping.
Interesting question. Ron, what do we know?
Well, I think that you can find that kind of material if you're interested in finding it. If you look back through newspaper clippings through the last, say, year, particularly in the Chicago media, and if you go to the campaign website and seek that information, there are also a number of books both by and about Barack Obama that go into his period as a community organizer, some of them with great disapproval of what the thing actually amounted to. So you can find a good deal of information on both sides of that question.
Mm-hmm. And David, I would suggest researching the Chicago Tribune website. Search the site. You might find something, even something brand new. Email from Mark here. A caller says, Mark asked how the Democrats can run on change with longtime Senator Joe Biden on the ticket. The change we're looking for is not a simple matter of new faces. We're talking about the need for a change in policy. Joe Biden's policies are very, very different, says Mark, from those of George W. Bush. Thus, he represents change. Is this really so hard to understand? That's a comment from Mark, at least. All right, let's go to a caller from Delaware. Hello, caller.
Yes, sir. I just have a question. All these years, the Republicans have been talking about the traditional family values. And in this case, I feel that the tables have turned. And the people are taking the opposite sides of what they believed in traditional values, and it's happening in the Republican Party now. And all of a sudden, they are so enthusiastic about somebody having a child out of a wedlock, that's okay. And Sarah Palin also, she was had a baby, less than 9 months before she got married, and she talks about abstinence teaching. And she didn't follow that. The other question is, she has a privilege of taking her child, who is disabled, to her workplace. How many of ordinary people like me, if we have, even if we have an able child, a working mom in a diner, can she take her baby to the workplace? How many employers would allow that?
Well, I think that's seems like a rhetorical question, Ron. Our caller doesn't think very highly of Sarah Palin and is articulating a particular position, huh?
Well, this has been one of the first things that was raised back a week ago, 10 days ago, when she was first named as vice president. And in fact, I would say going back even further than that, months ago when her name first emerged among those names of possible vice presidential choices, there was some question as to how seriously she should be taken for the job, not only because of the fairly limited experience that she had in government, but because she has this large and rather young family. One of her children is about to leave to go to Iraq, but she has four other children at home and about to be a grandmother and so on. A lot going on in her life, and questions were raised early on as to whether or not it would even be something she would accept if she were offered the vice presidency. Well, that question was quickly resolved. But she is, like any other American woman, entitled to decide to what degree she wants to spend each waking hour as a stay-at-home mother and to what degree she wants to add into her life hours of responsibility of another kind, whether that is the kind of work she has to do in order to make a living to put food on the table, as it is for many American women who have to be the sole support in many cases of their children or whose husbands need the supplement to their income. It might not be a case of absolute necessity in her case, but it is a choice that all American women have, whether they're going to spend all their time at home with their children, as they may prefer or not prefer, but it's a choice that they're allowed to make. And that would certainly apply to her as well.
We've been talking with NPR News Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. You can read Ron's Watching Washington column at NPR.org and hear the weekly NPR podcast, It's All Politics, at that same website. Ron, thanks for taking the time in a very busy season here to be with us. Appreciate
it. My pleasure, Fred. Good to be with you.
When we come back in open forum at listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Foundation, proud to present Power Philanthropy, a powerful new giving tool available to everyone. More information is available on the web at columbusfoundation.org.